You can't get very far in western Wisconsin without crossing over moving water. Creeks, streams, rivers, flowages. They seem to be everywhere. In fact, we are blessed with an overabundant supply of water resources. But that said, they are not infinite or immune to harm by our hands. So, how healthy are our rolling waters? We'll talk about our rivers and streams this hour on the West Side. I'm Rich Kramer, and I'd like to welcome to the program three gentlemen who spend their days studying and advocating for our rivers, streams, creeks, lakes, you name it. First, I'd like to welcome Bill James. Bill is a research aquatic biologist with UW Stout. He's a professor there. He formerly was with the Army Corps' Engineer Research and Development Center in Ogallee. Bill, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks, Rich.
Next, Paula Liberty. He's with the DNR. He's a water resources supervisor for Western Wisconsin, based right here in Eau Claire. Thanks for joining us, Paul.
Good morning, Rich.
And John Duke Welter made the drive from the Cooley region. He's with Trout Unlimited, working with their driftless area restoration effort.
Thanks. Nice to be here, Rich.
Good to have you. I saw some cringes when I said maybe an overabundant supply of water resources. I take that back. What I meant was maybe oversaturated by some accounts, but nonetheless. So I think generally to set up the discussion, we should probably talk about what rivers and streams actually do for us beyond, people might think fishing or canoeing or whatever. How vital are these to our daily lives? And then we'll get into a little bit of, what actually makes up a river. And I'll start with Bill James.
Hi. A watershed is really a catchment area. It's a confined area that catches all the precipitation, and it's made up of a network of various tribs. Up in the headwaters, we have first-order tributaries, and they are generally, very small. They capture runoff from forests and, prairies. Their flow velocities are slow. And as we move downstream, they flow into second-order tributaries and so on, all the way up to very higher-order tributaries. For instance, the Mississippi River is like a ninth-order tributary. And as we go downstream, function changes. Channels get wider and deeper. Flow velocity increases as more water enters the river. The river starts interacting with its floodplain too. During storms and high water pulses, water can move into the floodplain, various backwater channels, side channels, and these are really hot spots for nutrient processing and temporary sediment storage. There are a lot of organisms, a lot of diversity, and these types of habitats can really reduce nutrient and sediment input downstream. Hmm. Finally, as we get into the higher order tribs, they really sort of become conduits and move the rest of the nutrients and sediment into the ocean, basically. For instance, the Gulf of Mexico.
Right. And when we talk about these catchment areas, we're also talking about basins. And, we're talking, say, for a Chippewa River, for example. How large of an area drains into that?
Right. This is a very large area. I don't know the exact acreage, but just a tremendous network of streams and tributaries. Generally the upper headwater tributaries, they have some capacity. They can retain. They act as buffers. They can retain nutrients to a certain extent. They can retain sediment, various log jams and rock boulders and structure like that can really buffer runoff. you know, this this becomes overwhelmed when we start intensively growing crops or intensive urbanization occurs. Mm-hmm. This can overwhelm these headwater systems and resulting in nutrients moving downstream. Mm-hmm. Eventually, they can move into impoundments like Lake Wissota on the Chippewa River or Lake Holcomb. And this causes eutrophication. Impoundments on these watersheds basically trap what the watershed can't buffer, mm-hmm. and this results in poor water quality.
Before we get too deeply into the excess nutrients, what some of the problems as far as water quality are? You were going to bring up a point, Duke Welter.
Well, Rich, the Chippewa starts up in the area of the Turtle Flambeau flowage in Vilas and Oneida counties near between Park Falls and Mercer.
Sure.
It comes from Glidden and Butternut area. Hmm. That's about 40 miles south of Ashland, all the way down to its mouth at the Mississippi. So it drains a huge area, and it's a pretty good example, like a lot of our waterways. When you think about the intense change that we've wrought to so many of these systems since European settlement in this area, it's astonishing to countenance at times what kind of dramatic changes we put in place. So the Chippewa and the Red Cedar and the Wisconsin rivers, for instance, are harnessed for and dammed for electrical generation. Every one of our streams and rivers, it seems, is modified by humans for one reason or another. The most of the fish structure on the upper Namekagon River that was there at the time of settlement was blown up by loggers in order for logs to have a smooth route down to the to the mills. Our land uses, of course, the forestry, busting the sod in order to plant crops have all resulted in tremendous amount of impact on our streams. And really what we're doing with a lot of the things that we're trying to do is to remedy the things that are going on that we figure are sort of unacceptable impacts. And it kind of is a lot of people's uses of these waters have been modified over the years by changes in the quality of the water. So if you think about people that grew up in the 1950s and 60s in Menominee, mm-hmm. And water skied and swam on Lake Menomon all the time, well, and you think about how much swimming and water skiing is going on Lake Menomon now, right. With its water quality, we've had tremendous changes going on just in our lifetimes. And we're dealing with those things, but we're also dealing with anticipated changes that we expect to happen, that the projections are going to happen over coming decades. Hmm. Trying to anticipate those and figure out how you're going to manage those resources.
Paula Liberty, you'd like to chime in on this. I mean, I imagine you are well familiar with Lakes Menomon or Tainter Lake and Lake Menomon and that kind of impact.
Well, this is kind of an exciting time to be in this profession because the science is advancing so much on understanding all these things that were just talked about here. We have new ways to measure the health of river biology. Geographic information systems enable us to do all kinds of modeling and projecting that we couldn't do in the past. And generally, I think what we're learning is that the bigger rivers are in pretty good shape. Where we tend to see our problems are when we put a dam on those rivers and we create a flowage and things slow down and things tend to cook a little bit and things turn green and warm up. So in our bigger river systems, the concerns seem to be around the flowages. Of course, that's where a lot of people focus their recreation. So that's going to be an issue. And the other one is in some of the smaller headwater streams. You know, they're more sensitive to intense land use. And so that's been interesting, learning all this and being able to describe things better.
Listeners, I want to have you join in the conversation as well. Give us a call at 800-228-5615. How healthy do you think our rivers and streams are? What What do you think some of the greater threats are to them? Give us a call. Let us know. The number, 1-800-228-5615. The phone lines are wide open. So the as far as the impoundments, where the water kind of has a chance to cook, as you mentioned, Paul of Liberty, one of someone I know would suggest, well, just get rid of them. Get rid of the dams. Let it do its thing like you're supposed to, or like it was meant to. Then you don't have blue-green algae stinking up the place.
Well, that is a viewpoint, and it tends to be a minority viewpoint,
yeah,
in a lot of the bigger flowages like Lake Wasota and Lake Altoona. But that's one way to deal with the problem. But there's some of these flowages exist in places where there aren't any other lakes, mm-hmm, and they're about the only place to go to do things that people want to do on lakes. So it's always on the suite of options, you know, to remove a dam, and it comes up occasionally. And typically what the DNR does is try to provide information to the decision makers, you know, the local owners of the dam, and try to make sure an informed decision gets made considering all the consequences on whether to have a dam or not to have a dam. And, of course, some dams generate hydropower, and that's a, you know, a green energy source. So that's just another one of the things to put on the list of considerations.
Sure. Duke Welter.
I don't know if many people are seriously contemplating the idea that there'd be a series of dam removals of major hydro generating dams, or,
right,
or those that are really producing a fair amount of energy. But there are legitimate reasons to take out dams in some circumstances.
Well, there's some private dams, aren't there?
There are some privately owned dams that need to be repaired, and the cost of the repairs are going to be more than the owner can countenance. And mm-hmm, River Falls is having a discussion right now about two small city-owned dams that are right a block off Main Street in River Falls on the Kinnikinnick River, and they're the last two dams on that river, and they generate a small amount of electricity at a pretty significant cost. Mm. They do make but they buy 98.5% of their electricity off the grid, so it's not like it's a crucial provider.
Sure.
But the function of the dams, or the effect of the dams on the river, is pretty dramatic. There are two shallow impoundments, about 15 acres. They're silted in. They're eutrophic. They're a lot of geese and not much other. There's no significant fishery there. And they bisect a really excellent trout river upstream and a pretty good trout river and a very scenic area downstream. And the falls in River Falls, of course, been buried since the 1850s. Mm-hmm. Now, River Falls is talking about relicensing, as proposed to relicense those dams for another 30-year period. But the interesting thing about the discussion in River Falls is that there's a serious discussion about the merits and demerits of those dams, and whether or not it's worthwhile for the city of River Falls, with all the impacts that those dams and impoundments have on that river, whether it's more worthwhile, whether they would have a better natural asset, a better community asset, better recreational opportunity, if they simply removed those, if it wouldn't be better for the city. And economically, there's a tremendous amount of recreational opportunity that could be developed as you got rid of those. And the other thing is that happens is that those impoundments are stormwater receptacles, and they get warm water and they get chemicals off the parking lots when there's a rainstorm, and that they need to have settling of that stormwater in order to not have such a bad impact on the river. So they're having a pretty robust discussion right now, and it's good for a community to have to look at these natural corridors and say, what do we really value about these? Because if you look back in Eau Claire's history, Eau Claire used its rivers for logs for the mills and for industrial waste flowage and all that sort of stuff. And even, 40 years ago, just post Clean Water Act, it was not a healthy place to play in. And now the Chippewa River through Eau Claire is such a delightful
resource with its bike trail, its riverside parks, the number of tubers and paddlers and swimmers that come through there, that you can see a whole shift in the attitude of people toward the function of their rivers. And it's healthy for a community to make that discussion.
Paula Liberty?
Well, I thought I would add to what Duke's saying to give people a little understanding of how these decisions on dams get made. Mm-hmm. You know, since this is a hydropower dam, it's regulated by the federal government, mm-hmm. an outfit called the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So they're the decision makers on what happens at the hydro piece of it. And DNR is consulted, as is Trout Unlimited and the city and everybody else. And we're going through that process now. And there'll be quite a number of studies that'll be done to get at the issues that Duke mentioned. And almost separate from that is the question of, does the community want a dam on that river or not? And so there's two decisions there. One is the federal government on how it should be licensed. And the other one is, does that community want a dam in the middle of their town or not? And we work with people on both those issues all the time.
And Bill James.
Yeah, and then just some general tidbits on dams. You know, they serve recreation, hydropower, flood control, and they're, you know, good, bad, and ugly things about dams. You know, they do – some of the bad things, they do cut off upstream, downstream mm-hmm. transport, you know, fish. This has been a big problem in the Pacific Northwest. And then levees, they can cut off interactions between the river and the floodplain. For instance, the Mississippi River, the upper Mississippi River, has a series of locks and dams. They have a series of levees and such. And this has really changed habitat tremendously, and diversity. What was once a braided river is now a homogeneous pool in areas. And these levees have cut off the floodplain. So, like, for instance, nitrate has been a big problem. Mm-hmm. The Mississippi just acts as a conduit, transporting nitrate down to the Gulf of Mexico. If there was more floodplain river interaction, this could potentially reduce or dissipate a lot of that nitrate and improve, you know, downstream problems.
So what are some of those problems? Once that nitrate and all those nutrients get to the ocean,
right.
what's happening down there?
Yeah, just about every major ocean in the world, or I'm sorry, river in the world, has become transporters of nutrients, and we've created these what are called dead zones, or zones of hypoxia, low oxygen, or no oxygen in our world's river estuary systems. And this has been detrimental to species. It's reduced diversity. It's reduced economic livelihood as well.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a big problem worldwide.
The dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico is directly impacted by the amount of nutrients and nitrogen and phosphorus that come from the states of Iowa, Illinois, Minnesota, and Wisconsin. So they're coming off our ag lands and heading downstream. And I remember visiting a research station in the Gulf of Mexico at Cocodrí some years ago and talking with people who study the dead zone. And what they did is they studied the number of conservation programs that were intended to reduce those nutrients in the upper Mississippi. And the number of programs, the number of acres enrolled in those programs that reduced the nutrients that went in had a direct impact on the size of the dead zone from year to year.
Hmm.
So people down up here don't necessarily think about those kinds of downstream impacts.
Right. Well, let's take our first call of the morning. We've got Jody in Downing. Thanks for calling in. What's on your mind?
Hi. This is really pertinent because yesterday, Sunday, and Saturday night, we must have gotten at least 5 inches of rain, mm-hmm. and we live in a valley where we're a 4-mile watershed comes raging down from my my neighbor's farm field, and it was, you know, we know what's in it. It's, you know, it's the farm chemicals, it's the atrazine, and this is going into a small trout stream. So, you know, one question I had was, it sure seems like everybody is growing corn now because of the ethanol, and I just don't know, you know, how do you slow that down or get them to quit using quite so many chemicals? And then one other question I had is, I have two neighbors recently that don't have a lot of cattle, but they each have, on a small piece of land, like 6 cattle that are in the stream all the time. Is that legal at this point? So I am very concerned about our streams and our rivers.
Thanks so much. You. Thanks for the call. Great questions, Jody. So first of all, let's start with the runoff and more corn being planted.
Right.
Bill James, I mean, it's the commodity. It's a commodity we all use, and it's also becoming more profitable for farmers. So
Right. What's
happening?
Yeah, to the detriment of our streams. Clearing the land, deforestation, row cropping have all enhanced runoff instead of infiltration. Normally, much of the precipitation becomes intercepted by leaves in the forest and evaporates directly or infiltrated in soil by clearing the land. And in particular, row crop production, we're promoting runoff at a time, especially in the upper Midwest here, when we have our rainstorms. So, you know, the ground is pretty much bare right now, and there's no cover. So the precipitation quickly runs off. It enters our tributaries. They're overwhelmed. This creates flashy flood conditions. And it conveys all the nutrients and other chemicals that are on the field.
Direct. And what about cattle in the water? I mean, I imagine as far as – I don't know if you can speak to the legality of it, but I imagine that would affect trout stream kind of habitat or it, could.
Well, the thinking is changing about – about whether or not grazing and healthy streams are compatible, and for a long time we've taken the attitude that we need to fence cattle out of streams, and that has resulted in some challenges because it allows invasive species to grow in there, and the cattle don't graze them off. But what we found is that in a lot of places we can have a reasonable amount of grazing. Where the cattle are rotated in and rotated out, and control that vegetation, and there it isn't illegal. It's a matter of farming practices, and there are a lot of grazers who are doing responsible things in there with their grazing practices and protecting the land and the stream. So we're doing a lot of that in the Driftless area, and because I think that there are a lot of places where. Well-managed grazing systems have the likelihood that they're going to be able to keep dairy farmers on the land, and we don't have to turn things over to row crop agriculture.
Sure.
But at the same time, we're losing and we have the benefit of Organic Valley as something like 1,200 dairy producers that are involved in that co-op, and there are a lot of people that are taking good care of their land through rotational grazing. And we find that we can work with them on restoration projects that result in both healthy pastures and healthy cattle systems and healthy streams.
Paul Liberty, from the DNR's perspective, why don't you weigh in?
Well, we do have some regulations that sort of indirectly get at the livestock access issue, and they don't ban the livestock access, but what it does do is list as a prohibited practice where the intensity is such that the sod or the grass is gone, that mm-hmm. it's all bare dirt in that critical zone near the stream. So there are some regulations about that, and doing something about that requires a partnership between DNR and the County Conservation Department, and it requires some cost share money to be offered. So there are some regulations on that. And as to other sources in a watershed, you know, we've been talking about cropland runoff, and there's some very positive things that have happened on the conservation front that catch that water and infiltrate it rather than running it off. There's conservation tillage methods. There's cover crop methods. And they're sort of all over the place. If you look hard enough, you can see them, but they're not commonly practiced. And that's what we need to all do, is to encourage that stuff to be more widely utilized.
We're having, this is all about gravity. I mean, you know, Bill's talking about these systems, and basically water's flowing downhill, and in some places there's more downhill, and so it flows faster, and it's more of a challenge. And the soils are a real key, and the vegetation's a real key. And, you know, gravity never takes a day off, and it's working 24 hours, and it's working overtime today with that rain we have had. And so we're trying to deal with a lot of that. And historically, some historic practices are having trouble being practiced in some places. For a long time, we had contour strips across the Driftless area that followed the horizontal contours of the topography, and they'd have a row of corn or beans in some cases, and then a row of a grass,
sure,
or hay or something, and the grass, the hay would hold the soil, and there'd be more runoff from the corn. Well, in a lot of places in this rush to corn agriculture, we have more absentee owners of land that have the land under sort of a short-term management scheme, and they're taking out contour strips, and they're taking out grass waterways and things that hold the soil in place. And no-till agriculture is helpful, but it's not a solution in every place. So we're having more soil that is coming down either in low ground ways or in sheets off the hillsides. That's been a problem. But one of the things that we do with our restoration projects is we put in a vegetated buffer along these streams that might be 30 or 40 or 50 feet wide, and it is deeper rooted species that develops a turf that catches some of that stuff before it gets into the water. So we're catching nutrients and fertilizer and pesticides and soil.
40 to 50 feet, that'd be enough.
Well, actually, in most of our streams, we could probably get by with between 30 and 35 feet in a lot of places.
Well, gentlemen, let's take our first break here before time eludes us too much here. When we get back, we're going to talk about some of the harmful things that are getting into our rivers. We've already gotten into the nutrients, but I want to continue on that front. We've also got a caller on the line, Willem in Colfax. Hang tight. We'll be right back, and we'll get to your call. This is the West Side. We're talking about the health of our rivers and streams, our moving waters in western Wisconsin. If you've got a question or a comment for our panel of experts here, give us a call, 800-228-5615. We'll be back in just a bit. I'm Rich Kramer, and you're listening to the West Side this Monday morning on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're talking about rivers and streams in western Wisconsin. How healthy are they? Some of the risks that, or some of the things that are impacting them in the wrong way. We've got a panel of guests, including Bill James. He's a research aquatic biologist with UW Stout. Paula Liberty is a DNR Water Resources Supervisor for western Wisconsin. And John Duke Welter is with the Trout Unlimited, working with their Driftless Area Restoration effort. Listeners, give us a call. Let us know what you think. Do you think more work needs to be done to keep our watersheds clean and free of excess nutrients, clean of sediment, clean of chemicals, toxic things? The number is 800-228-5615. And with that, let's go to Willem in Colfax. And Willem, you're on the air. Thanks for calling in.
Good morning.
Good morning.
You know, I think we all realize how important water is. No life without water. I think we all know that. And I was just reading recently about a recent study that was done in April 2013 that was saying that the warming climate and modern farming practices are contributing to these algae blooms. And I know that from traveling around western Wisconsin. A lot of the small lakes, like around Amory and other places, and even the Apple River is like floating islands of algae every summer. But the other reason I wanted to call was about recent changes to wetland mitigation, about being able to just, you know, for developers to fill in wetlands and then either mitigated by paying a fee or by digging a hole somewhere else in the state. It doesn't even have to be in the same watershed. So I find it that troubling when our political leaders, the people who are supposed to protect our interests, are passing laws like that when they either don't understand the importance of wetlands as filters and habitat places, or they think that just digging a hole somewhere else. And, you know, I think this is what happens when you have, like, a real estate developer being the head of the DNR instead of someone who has a background and knowledge about how these systems work. So I think it's important for people to call their representatives and let them know, that the people, they're supposed to be working for the people's interest, not just some specific.
Willem, thank you so much. Let's put that to Duke Welter. I mean, mm-hmm. We have seen some changes in the laws regarding wetlands and then development. What are your thoughts?
Well, I understand exactly what Willem's talking about, because we have a number of places in the state that we have pernicious water quality problems that we have not been able to solve, some water quantity problems that we are not able to solve, mm-hmm. and we have problems coming that if our present approach continues, we're not going to be able to solve them. So for years we've had problems with manure in private wells, in karst topography, limestone bedrock in Kewaunee area, Algoma area, that has made people sick. And we've had tremendous difficulty in trying to get that cleaned up. In the Central Sands in Wisconsin, we're having lakes that are drying up, and we got a tremendous amount of straws that are going into those aquifers and drawing out water to the point that the Little Plover River has been drying up, which is a Class 1 trout stream near Stevens Point. It's been drying up for 10 years, and we don't seem to have the tools or the will to keep the water in those streams. And we can't, somehow the climate is such that we are not sitting down at the table and trying to figure out how we can come to stronger protective approaches. And finally, that Hard Rock Mining Bill in the last session of the legislature, I believe, is going to run afoul of the Clean Water Act, because it allows overburden from that mine to be dumped into trout streams if they're shorter than 2 miles long, as a place for refuse disposal, and that's going to be leaking a lot of stuff into the water. So we need to change some of those things, and we need to recognize that the waters of this state belong to the people of this state, and it is good for this state to protect them, and we're not doing all that we could in the current climate.
Paul at Liberty?
Well, from the DNR staff perspective, you know, we always try to do the best job we can do applying the laws as they're written. And
right.
We have to confine ourselves to, you know, the laws as they're written, not as, you know, somebody might like them to be written. So we'll do the best job we can with the tools we have.
Bill James.
And, you know, with regards to climate change, you know, I think this is going to be an issue, you know, as we mobilize nutrients and have a longer growing season. We're going to see, longer periods of these noxious cyanobacterial blooms and the potential for cyanotoxins that can be harmful to humans and animals and fish. So it's all sort of coming together in a bad way. I think we need to be really concerned about it.
The cyanobacteria, you're talking about blue-green algae, noxious kind of blue-green algae stuff, right?
Exactly, like right. They favor warm temperatures and high phosphorus concentrations.
Sure.
Many of them can obtain nitrogen from the atmosphere, so they don't. They can be competitive in that way.
Hmm.
So as we continue to mobilize phosphorus and allow it to run off, we're going to see longer stretches of these blooms as climate warms and changes.
So excess nutrients, nitrogen, phosphorus, as far as if you could rate the things that impact our local waters the most, would they be up among the top? Because I looked at the list of DNR's impaired waters, and you know, on the Chippewa River, there were some parts or some sections that said, okay, PCBs and mercury, and those, I mean, those were the nightmares from the past that we seem to be getting a good handle on. But by far, the most common thing that I saw as far as impaired waters was high levels of phosphorus. Is that the number one issue that we're facing in western Wisconsin, rural western Wisconsin, Paul the Liberty?
Well, I would say it's probably a loss of suspended material, soil running off, and usually that carries phosphorus with it. So when you get one, you get the other.
Sure.
So a lot of it is related to moving soil, eroding stream banks, croplands eroding. That not only carries phosphorus with it, but it erodes stream banks and buries fish habitat.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a really big one in western Wisconsin. We've got a few spots where, you know, that we've got some of these things from the past, you know, PCB and mercury and that going on. But for western Wisconsin, the biggest thing is probably the soil moving, the banks eroding. But you've got the possibility there, if you can deal with it, you not only solve this habitat destruction problem, which is good for the trout, but you also cut off the supply of phosphorus.
Mm-hmm.
So there's many reasons to work on that issue.
Well, the DNR took a look, and I thought it was like a two-decade deal where they came up looking at the Red Cedar River and came up with the Red Cedar TMDL, total maximum daily load, I believe is how it works. So what it is a comprehensive study looking at how much of these things are in the water, also some recommendations to possibly clean it up. And I just found a list of the recommendations, just one of the, you know, kind of bullet points. But conservation tillage, we've talked about that a little bit. Try to eliminate winter manure spreading, phosphorus-based. I mean, the list goes on and on. But you mentioned earlier something that I think a lot of people might not know about. The cost share that's involved with the NR 130 or 151, and I'm just wondering. So does that mean that the DNR can't or tell a farmer to do some of these practices without paying for a majority of it?
Well, the performance standards is what we're talking about. They're an administrative rule called NR 151.
Mm-hmm.
They lay out a bunch of things that are sort of the basic expectations of farming. And there's a few things that we can require. And by we, I mean it's almost always a partnership between DNR and the County Conservation Department.
Okay.
You know, that's how these things get done. And there's a few things like moving a manure pile that's too close to the stream. We don't need to offer cost share for that.
Okay.
But for anything that involves structural fixes, it's written right into that administrative rule that a 75% cost share needs to be offered in order for us to take enforcement action.
Mm-hmm. When was that written into law? Was this like way back when? Or?
Oh, this was in the
2000s. Oh, it was.
Yeah, in the 2000s. It's not that far back.
So, Duke Welder, do you see that being written into law as some kind of a hamstringing effect on conservation?
Well, I think that Paul and I are in agreement that the DNR works hard to enforce the rules that it has. The problem that it has is that statutorily its authority can be taken away by the legislature, and that happens.
Mm-hmm.
And if they don't have the tools, they can't use the tools, and tools that are intended to protect our waters and to tools that are needed, say in the way of groundwater, are not in place, and that's where we need to be looking across a wide range of interests that are affected by those potential things. But when we got the state's first groundwater bill in about 2003, I guess, that was a result of different groups with different interests sitting down and saying, well, what do you need? What is the problem? What can you work with? And coming up with some protective standards for springheads and streams and those sorts of things and groundwater levels. We need to take some more steps along those lines in a variety of areas to try and strengthen the authority that DNR has. I also appreciate what Paul said about
sediment being the driver in a lot of these systems. And an old friend of mine who's now dead was at the University of Minnesota in water science, water resources for his whole career, and was pretty legendary over there. And he said, in the Driftless area, unless you can get a handle on the sedimentation, you're not going to solve anything. You're going to keep losing soil off the uplands and the hillsides, and you're going to have less low agricultural productivity, and your water quality is going to be lower, and your recreational and biotic potential of these streams is going to be lower. And so if you get a handle on the sediment, with it comes these other things. And so there's some really good programs out there, and the conservation titles of the Farm Bill are instrumental in our region. We're probably going to have $5 or $6 million this year that's spent across northeast Iowa and southeast Minnesota and southwest Wisconsin on Farm Bill, from the Farm Bill, along with a bunch of other money that we put together for restoration projects to try and get a handle first on that sedimentation. Because you look across our 600 watersheds in the Driftless area, and they almost all have a thick blanket of sediment on the bottom of the valleys that blew down into those valleys after we settled. And we broke the sod and we deforested the hillside, and that nice, soft, dark soil went right down into the valley floors. We're never going to get that back up on the ridgetops, but we got to figure out a way to keep that stream bank sedimentation from forever clogging those streams and being a major issue in water quality and biotic potential of those streams.
As far back to the nutrients and the sediment, Bill James, you worked did a lot of research on Half Moon Lake here in Eau Claire,
right.
And I know we're talking about lakes here, but it was part of a river at one point or some. So there's a whole mess of phosphorus in that lake, and I thought it was really interesting. We actually did a show about it. I had you on before about the the steps that the city took to try to cut down the loading of it, the nutrient loading. But then you got out there with a boat and dumped hundreds of thousands of gallons of alum. So how did that work out?
Well, yeah, it was a two-pronged attack. The first part was trying to control this invasive curly leaf pondweed. It was an aquatic plant. And then the second one was to control sediment phosphorus recycling. We're in our third year of that. This is actually the fourth year. We've decreased phosphorus and algae in the water by nearly 70%. I've got my fingers crossed. If we can say that during the fifth year, next year, I will be very pleased and excited that this has been a huge success. Mm-hmm. We've got native plants growing in the lake. We had a little setback in 2012. There was a wind shear that uprooted a significant portion of the plants, mm-hmm. but they've recovered. So it's clear right now, and I hope it stays that way.
Well, wasn't there also a bit of a setback when, or maybe it was known all along, that despite all the efforts of the city to keep the excess nutrients from getting in there, the lawn fertilizer, whatnot, that it's coming in through pumps?
Yeah, we do have a phosphorus load coming in. Luckily, that's not having an impact on the lake so far.
Okay. Paul of Liberty?
Well, I just want to point out that what's happening on Half Moon Lake here is something that, could happen in other places. But
sure.
It's important to remember, the way Half Moon Lake started was to work in a watershed, to look at where all the water is coming from, where all this sediment is coming from that we're talking about, where the phosphorus is coming from, and cut off the huge supply. And once you've done that, well, then you can start looking into the lake itself and try some things like Bill has tried. Mm-hmm. But if you continue to get massive loads of this stuff washing into the lake, it doesn't pay to...
You can bind it all you want.
Yeah, it just doesn't pay. So it's been an interesting thing to watch that play out, and we're hoping to maybe duplicate that in some other places around the state.
Duke Welter, we're up against a break here.
Sure.
But it's interesting. It needs to be said that there's some really interesting developments going on in these watersheds that are moving things forward. And one of them is in the Red Cedar, that has become a watershed where people are starting to work together up and down the watershed. And the Red Cedar Conference last spring was an outstanding success with a lot of presentations and a lot of good ideas and a lot of motivated people that came out of that with ideas on how to deal with things. There are restoration efforts that are going on in Buffalo County. Great community conservation restoration efforts are going on trout streams there, and people are putting in all kinds of multiple species projects. And there's a stream day down at in Wamandy Creek this Saturday from 11 to 2 on Denuser Valley Creek that's going to invite a lot of people out to celebrate a project that they did, and it's community conservation at its best. It's really exciting.
Absolutely. Working together on these big issues is paramount. This is the West Side. We're talking about rivers and streams, the health of our rivers and streams in western Wisconsin. We've got Bill James, John Duke Welter, Paul Liberty on the program. We got a caller on the line. We'll be right back to start wrapping up the hour. I'm Rich Kramer, and this is the West Side on Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks for joining us this morning. We're talking about the health of our rivers and streams, our rolling waters in western Wisconsin. We've got Bill James of UW Stout, Paula Liberty of the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources, and John Duke Welter of Trout Unlimited. The number to call in and with questions or comments, 800-228-5615. We've got one on the line right now. We can maybe take another call right after this. But first, let's go to Rice Lake. Mick, you're on the air. Thanks a lot for calling in.
Well, thank you for having me on. I want to thank Bill and Paul and Duke for putting on this timely discussion. I'm in the Red Cedar Basin and involved in hopefully seeing things improve up here. And I got recently excited by an article I saw in the Eau Claire Leader about the U.S. Department of Ag and their new, it's called Regional Comprehensive or Conservation Partnership Program. And I'm wondering if, I think Duke had talked a bit, maybe it was Bill and Paul, talked a bit about cooperative efforts here and trying to have dollars available to help improve. And I'm wondering if they are aware of that and could comment for us about that.
Sure. Thanks a lot, Mick. Duke.
Yes, Mick. That program was just announced last week, and it's really an important opportunity for the upper Midwest to identify priority challenges in watersheds, and I think the Red Cedar is a good example of that, that it would be nice to be able to target some conservation dollars from USDA for that, and it gives you a whole nother tool to go after some money under this existing farm bill. I think it's going to be about a third of their EQIP money is going to be available for those kinds of projects. And it may be that if you work with the Fishers and Farmers Partnership of the National Fish Habitat Initiative, they may end up being able to help steer you in the right direction. But that's a real promising program for our region. Absolutely.
Sounds great.
Yeah.
All right. Thanks so much, Mick. Paul Liberty.
Well, I wanted to spin off of what Duke said about the conference on the Red Cedar.
Yep.
That's one that we've been involved with since the beginning, and they also occur on the St. Croix and on the Wisconsin River. And I just wanted to announce that we're looking on having our first one for the Lower Chippewa River. And
a beautiful area.
And we're talking about having something on Saturday, September 6th. Here in Eau Claire, a whole bunch of people are working on it, not only within the city, but nonprofits. And so we're hoping to have something both on the river and on the banks of the river, and perhaps in Hobbs Ice Arena is what we're looking at right now. So I want people to look for the publicity of that coming out, and we'll begin this process of getting together and celebrating the Lower Chippewa this fall.
Absolutely. Now, with that, we've got a couple minutes left, gentlemen. Duke, you were talking about some future threats or some things coming up. What kind of things are you're talking about? I mean, we're starting to make some efforts on some of these rivers, and more needs to be done, but what can we look for in the future?
I think
I think the work that's being done in the Driftless area on tributaries in Minnesota and Wisconsin is encouraging and has the opportunity to expand to deal with nitrogen and phosphorus and sedimentation, and it brings together a lot of different kinds of local and state and national groups to address those sorts of things. So we've added 100 miles of restoration in the last 10 years. We've added 250 miles of public access, and we recognize that it's about a $1 billion industry just to have recreational fishing in the Driftless area. Mm-hmm. So those things are all valuable, and communities are starting to recognize that. At the same time, we're seeing the what's happened in our lifetime in terms of even temperature change in the summer is dramatic, and the prospect of future heavy rain events and those sorts of things is another challenge that faces us. It's going to have an impact on streams, agricultural productivity, fisheries, infrastructure, lots of things, and we need to anticipate those.
All right, Paul Liberty, very quickly, we're close to the top of the hour.
Well, I see a lot of people coming together under the concepts of farmers harvesting water and encouraging their soil health, because if you can harvest this water and infiltrate it, it solves so many of these problems. You know, you don't have soil running off, you don't have nutrients running off, you're bolstering the groundwater, you're protecting the stream from climate change. I mean, it brings it all together, and it's something that people can rally around because it increases farm profitability and it protects the environment.
And Bill James, any last words?
I think the only other threat that we didn't mention is invasive species. We've always got that. We've become a global species environment,
right.
And there are threats all the time.
All right. Well, gentlemen, thank you so much. That's our time. I'd like to thank my guests, Bill James, Paula Liberty, and John Duke Welter, for their discussion this morning. It was very good. Thank you so much. Also, I'd like to thank Team Westside for helping out put this program together, including Mort Cypress, Henry Lippold, Tiffany Coggins, and Dean Collenbeck. Also, we've got a new addition to the Westside, Sadie Horton. She'll be helping produce our programs, and we'll be writing the occasional news story. Tune in next week. We'll talk with state politicians from Western Wisconsin.